the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Take 2, me Martinez. We've had some time and space to assess the fallout of Governor Newsom's revised budget for California. We'll hear about all the cuts and the one big can he kicked down the road. Plus, Griffith Park has the observatory, the zoo, the Greek Theater, but you already know that. A new book will fill you in on all the amazing things in Griffith Park you may not know about. It's all ahead on Take 2. Stay with us. From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take 2. I'm Martinez. It's Friday. We made it. Coming up a little later in the show, we're going to hear some pro tips on navigating Griffith Park.
So if you call one of the rangers and you need help, or you're trying to tell them where you are, if you see something with a number on it, tell them that number and they'll know exactly where you are.
That's coming up in just a few minutes. And by the way, the Rams, if you haven't seen already, the LA Rams came out with their new uniforms this week. A few weeks ago, the LA Chargers came out with theirs. If you go to my Twitter page at AMartinezLA, that's AMartinezLA, you can vote on who has the best uniforms. I know there's a lot of fashionistas out there, so just vote at AMartinezLA. All right, we're going to start off this Friday with some state of affairs. That's our weekly peek at politics in the Golden State. And this week, cuts, cuts, and sadly more cuts as the state tries to fill a $54 billion hole in the budget. We'll hear at how lawmakers are responding. Meanwhile, California's fiscal future may hinge on Nancy Pelosi's HEROES Act. So why is it facing steep odds in Congress? Those stories, plus a Republican victory in LA's 25th district. We're going to get into all of that with Marisa Lagos, political correspondent for KQED. Welcome, Marisa.
Hey.
Also with us, Zach Corser. He co-directs the Policy Lab at Claremont McKenna College. Welcome to you, Zach.
Great to be here, eh?
All right, Marisa, let's start with you. The revised May budget is not nearly as rosy as the January budget. As I mentioned, deficit north of $54 billion. Cuts being made to education, healthcare, parks, recreation. It also puts the kibosh on Governor Newsom's Medi-Cal expansion. What were the most striking features of this new budget proposal in your view?
You know, I think the fact that this is going to sound weird, but in some ways it's not as bad as we thought in this sense. It's bad, okay? But, you know, we were hearing this $54 billion number, and it wasn't really clear, like, what that was going to mean for this year and next year, or whether that was spread over many years. So comparatively, the $19 billion shortfall they're, projecting isn't quite as bad. And I think that the fact that, I mean, two things. One is that Newsom is clearly trying as much as he can to cushion the blow to schools. They would have been facing $18 or $19 billion in cuts alone, and he has moved around some money, so that's closer to $10 billion. That's still going to be incredibly painful at a time when school districts were already struggling. The other thing is, I think there are some lessons we're already seeing, sort of having been learned from the last downturn. You know, Newsom isn't proposing steep cuts to Medi-Cal or welfare payments, things like that. I think that this budget is attempting, and I don't know if it will be able to do this, but to balance what we know, which is that individuals are hurting, and they're trying to sort of make these cuts as soft as possible. Because the truth is, you know, the budget is directly related to the economy. And one of the reasons that we're in this mess right now is that all these sales taxes and income taxes, all these things are going down so quickly because of this drop off in employment. So I think Newsom's trying to sort of do both things at the same time, and it's a hard juggle.
Yeah, there's pretty much no economy, so how can you get sales tax out of no economy?
Right.
And it looks like Governor Newsom is trying not to be penny wise, pound foolish, but it also seems like he's kicking a pretty big can down the road when it comes to pensions. Zach, what did he do, and does it just add to maybe the uncertainty around pension liabilities in the state?
Well, we all know what a big problem unfunded liabilities for pensions are in California, both for local governments and for the state. And this move reflects a change in economic realities. You know, before COVID, Newsom was planning to put $2.3 billion extra as a payment towards unfunded liabilities to state pensions. But he's having to change that plan. He's going to redirect that money towards local school districts and community colleges to help them deal with their own payments to retirees. But here's the big question is, how's CalPERS going to do during this whole pandemic? Are they going to be able to weather the storm? We'll remember back to 2008 and a big drop in CalPERS and some over-optimistic assumptions really led to these unfunded mandates. mandates. CalPERS, you know, we'll, you know, we have to watch how well markets will come back. But, you know, we could be seeing a huge hole in CalPERS, you know, as we are dealing with all these other problems. So, you know, saving $2.3 billion now, I don't know if it's going to cost us more in the long run, but it's just more of the complexities of dealing with the pandemic.
And Marisa, we touched on this yesterday with Zach, but the proposed 10% pay cut for state workers could put Newsom on a collision course with unions. How have unions responded?
Oh, you know, they don't like it. but who's going to say that they like it? I mean, this is not, I mean, and also, you know, I think the fact that he's asking for a pay cut instead of saying we're going to have to do deep layoffs in itself is indicative of how he's trying to approach this. I think to Zach's point, you know, they are trying to trade off the sort of short-term pain with the longer-term pain. And I think one of the real big question marks here is what the future looks like. And none of us know because this pandemic happened so suddenly. And I think there is some hope that it could end suddenly too, if we do get therapies or vaccines, right? And so this is different. It is a different calculation. I can see the argument for deferring some of these payments. But you know, they're deferring the payments to let the school districts make their own pension payments, right? Because that is what is squeezing school districts, is that both the state and the districts have to pay into these pension funds. And so I do think that it's not the probably in a perfect world what you would do, but I think it's Newsom looking at what's happening on the ground. And again, I think we always have to, when we talk about schools too, mention that not only were they already facing these deficits, but they're being asked to rethink how we educate kids, right? I mean, this is a time when we could probably double our teaching staff and not have enough people. So it's tough. And I think that, you know, it's not surprising that they're looking at pensions as one way to kind of paper this over.
And Marisa, I keep saying Governor Newsom's budget. I should add the word proposal because it's a budget proposal, needs final approval from the state legislature. You spoke with Republican Assemblyman Kevin Kiley for your podcast Political Breakdown yesterday. What's his take and his perspective, you know, representative of how other Republicans might feel about it?
So I found this really interesting. You know, Kiley and other Republicans are still, the first thing out of their mouths is, we can't believe that they're not repealing AB 5, which was that law around forcing independent contractors to come on staff at places like Uber and Lyft and a bunch of, you know, thousands and thousands of other companies. I kind of pushed him on that because that they did put $20 million for enforcement on that. To him, he thinks that's indicative of the sort of problems in Sacramento. He says it represents the fact that, you know, people like Newsom in his mind are not kind of in tune with what people on the ground need. I've also heard a lot of calls to eliminate high-speed rail from Republicans. Neither of those obviously would eliminate this budget deficit. So I think that they feel, you know, like the state needs to kind of rethink its priorities broadly. But as you know, they have, you know, Democrats have a super duper majority and we have a Democratic governor. So where the rubber meets the road is going to be with those Democrats largely.
Yeah, more than likely. Now, Zach, during his speech yesterday, Governor Newsom threw his support behind Nancy Pelosi's $3 billion HEROES Act. Under the act, states and local governments would divvy up about a trillion dollars in federal funds. Now, doing a quick compare and contrast, how much might life in California look with that federal help and without that federal help?
Well, I mean, it's an interesting strategy, first off, in the sense that essentially Newsom's proposal sets up this idea of triggering cuts. That is to say, if the HEROES Act doesn't get passed, there will be a trigger of cutting K-12 and higher ed. There'll be a trigger for Medi-Cal cuts. There'll be a trigger for the salary cut to parks. I mean, some major cuts. And it's a political gambit to put more pressure on Washington to pass this HEROES Act and get that political pressure out of California. But, you know, Nancy Pelosi's caucus, I don't know that it's really solid on this one. There was a procedural vote earlier today where 14 Democrats voted against the procedural decision to whether or not to actually vote on the HEROES Act. Ro Khanna voted against it. Abigail Spanberger, who's on the other side, she's very moderate, she voted against it too. So it's a weird political gambit, and I think there's a lot riding on it in the sense that I don't know if it's going to pass. There's a lot of uncertainty within the caucus and particularly with the GOP, but if it doesn't happen, I think we're going to see we're going to feel the pain. We're going to see some potential bankruptcies with cities. We're going to see deep cuts to services. People will feel the effects on schools, on the social safety net, on health care. We're all going to feel the impact. So, I mean, there's a real need here, but I think California's got to get seriously consider, like, what's plan B here?
Now, do you think it's not going to get out of the House? Or because, it's not going to get out of the Senate, I don't think, but the House?
Well, I think it's going to get out of the House,
okay.
But like I said, there's enough. They're not unified. That is to say, Pelosi can't afford to lose a vote on this. She's got to show unanimity. She's got to show that her caucus is together on this one, because the real challenge will come in the Senate, where this could just end up being a dead letter. You know, Pelosi did not reach out to the Senate. The Republicans have been using this as an opportunity to attack Democratic state budgets, saying that they're too big, making, you know, picking and choosing about what state governments should be spending on. It's really descended into kind of a partisan food fight. And so if her caucus isn't allied on this going into that battle, I think it just sort of weakens the effort overall.
Talking to Zach Corser, co-directs the Policy Lab at Claremont McKenna College, and Marisa Lagos, political correspondent at KQED. When it comes to the HEROES Act, Marisa, what are the key components to this act? And what has Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell and the president said about it?
Well, I mean, the centerpiece is this idea of giving nearly $1 trillion to state and local governments. But there's other things in here, including this idea of expanding, you know, some of the unemployment benefits. There's money in there for the post office, which Trump has just outright rejected. It is sort of like any $3 trillion bill, I guess, a Christmas tree of sorts. I think it is a negotiating tactic by Pelosi. I mean, she knows that she holds the lever to one branch or one half of one branch of government, right? And that she needs Republicans. I think to Zach's point, it's going to be interesting to see. I mean, California is not alone in this, right? This is not a California pandemic. This is a global pandemic. And so if you look at states, you know, Kentucky, for example, they will likely be facing similar situations to California. And so I do think that there will be some pressure from red states, from red state governors on people like McConnell to do something, probably not as wide as what Pelosi wants. And I do think it's fascinating that on the one hand, you have people like the Progressive Caucus saying this doesn't go far enough. We need to do more to put, you know, money into hands of people who work for businesses that could be laying them off so that they don't get laid off and they're not on unemployment. You have people sort of more in the center of the Democratic Party arguing that they need to essentially expand a lot of these benefits, like the $600 supplement to unemployment that just ends in July, at the end of July. What people who oppose that say is like that based on nothing. There's not going to be a change between July 31st and August 1st. So I think Zach's right. I think that there are a lot of challenges for Pelosi. I think she wanted to stake out her position publicly on what needed to be in this. And, now the real fun begins.
Would pressure from red state governors, Marisa, the work on Mitch McConnell? It seems like he's got Teflon when it comes to pressure sometimes. I don't think it reaches him sometimes.
But he doesn't have Teflon when it comes to his caucus. And if they feel like their members are at risk because they're not getting the support, giving the support at home that people want and need, I do think that that could change the dynamic. I mean, look, like we saw that happen very quickly with the first couple stimulus and response acts to COVID-19. First, nothing was going to happen. And then a week later, they were passing these huge packages. So never say never. I mean, the other interesting point here is that we have an election in November, and if Democrats are successful in taking back the White House and Senate, which is a big if, things could look really different. And I think that's one of the reasons probably why Newsom wrote the budget the way he did, with those automatic clawbacks of the cuts if they get federal money, because that could happen at any point in the next fiscal year.
Funny thing, we're going to need the post office in California for that election.
Yeah,
right? Yeah, so that's the irony there.
Yeah, that's a problem.
Yeah, Zach, so ultimately, is the Republicans' reluctance to even look at this bill based on policy, politics, or a mix of both?
Oh, it's a mix. You know, as I said earlier, you know, Mitch McConnell's basically said he doesn't want to, quote, blue state bailout. He's trying to make it sound like if there's an interest in bailing out, or I shouldn't say bailing out, just helping with relief for state and local governments, that somehow this is a blue state problem. Let's see how far he can push that as a theory, however, because I do think, you know, across the board, there is a problem throughout the nation, whether you're red or blue, in terms of the impact on state and local budgets. There may be a little playing around here in terms of, you know, trying to make the case, like Republicans are starting to make here in California, that there are types of spending that they don't want to help with. You know, this can't be just an automatic block grant to the states, that it's going to come with strings attached. So it will reflect Republican policy preferences. That may be a gambit that they try to put out there to get some control over things. But, you know, the question is, who has control, who has leverage? And it's a tough battle. There's not the kind of pressure that we felt for the first relief package that came out. But there's an old saying in Washington, it used to be a joke and now it's getting kind of serious, it used to say a billion here, a billion there, pretty soon you're talking real money. Now it's a trillion here, a trillion there. And I think, you know, Republicans are also starting to take some deep breaths about the debt. I think there's people in the caucus, in the Senate and in the House, that are starting to wonder about how much debt America can take on. And they're also starting to ask questions about, should we be taking debt on for the kinds of relief that are being requested by the Democrats? So there's a lot of uncertainties here. There's certainly still a lot of continuing pressure, but politics is definitely going to play a role in what this final bill looks like if we actually get to the point of getting a final bill.
I was quickly trying to look up what's after a trillion. I couldn't quite find it.
Quintillion?
Yeah, I guess that's next, right? Marisa, one more thing today. Congressional District 25, that's the seat that was occupied by Katie Hill before she resigned last year. That seat flipped back to red. Republican Mike Garcia won it. How did Democrats lose this seat so quickly?
Well, it's a special election, and it's a very purple district. You know, it's one that Hillary Clinton carried by 7 points, but Newsom won by just a couple. They're going to be rematched in November. I'm not ready to draw any long-term conclusions about the health of either party based on this one special election in a very challenging sort of environment. But we do know that historically, special elections favor conservatives. They're more likely to have people used to voting by mail. And I think in November, when you have Trump on the ballot, and a lot of other questions before voters, it could be a very different dynamic. But it's still probably troubling for Democrats who do have some more challenging seats to defend that they did flip in 2018.
You know how we know, Marisa, that Zach's a policy person? Because he is correct. Right after a trillion is quadrillion. So he already has that money spent in his head. Zach Corser co-directs the Policy Lab at Claremont McKenna College. Marisa Lagos co-hosts the podcast Political Breakdown on KQED. Marisa, Zach, thanks a lot.
Have a great weekend.
Have a good weekend.
With the pandemic occupying pretty much all of our mental and emotional bandwidth the last few months, you'd be forgiven if you did not realize that we are creeping up on prime fire season. Yeah, prime fire season. Cue up the four horsemen of the apocalypse already. Coming up, we're going to hear what Southern California has in store as the weather heats up. That's next when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. More Take Two on 89.3 KPCC and the KPCC app. I'm A. Martinez. It's hot enough and dry enough outside that it's fair to say wildfire season is just about here. KPCC science reporter Jacob Margolis joins us to talk about the fire year ahead and how the coronavirus is complicating things. Hello, Jacob.
Hey, A.
All right, so what do we have in store for the coming months?
As of right now, Southern California is actually the only place, or one of the only places in the U.S. that has below normal wildfire potential, at least for the next few months. And that's because even though we had a really dry January, very, 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 very dry February, we did get a bunch of late season rains in March and April. And what that means is that all of the medium-sized brush and the big brush we see up in our mountains, they're still sucking up a lot of moisture from the ground, and moisture is the name of the game, eh? No matter how much you hate the word.
No, absolutely. Now, I assume that's because wet things don't burn as easily.
That's science,
yeah,
right there.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I believe in it.
That's why people are starting to see grass fires all over the place. So when we have a really hot day, like ones we've had recently, grass dries out really quickly, and you throw a windy day in there, if a fire starts, it'll burn through grassland really fast. That happened last week up in Hollister Ranch. Yeah. But as long as that bigger brush holds on to that moisture, we shouldn't see any absolutely devastating fires yet, at least here in Southern California. It is a different story up in Northern California, which missed a lot of the water that we got.
So when might that change for us here in Southern California?
We really dry out by late August, September, around there, depending on how hot the summer is, how much late rain we got. And then the Santa Anas come along and they dry things out sometime like October time of the year. Yeah. And those really push the fires along. And that's why we burn so much in the fall. Though last year, because of that late season rain, in part because of that, our fire season last year was actually mild compared to average.
Talking to KPCC science reporter Jacob Margolis. Now, earlier on the show today, we talked about how California is facing a $54 billion budget shortfall. Now, in his revised budget yesterday, Governor Newsom announced a whole lot of cuts. How did fire prevention fare?
Yeah, he made it clear. Newsom made it clear that fire suppression is a major consideration. He didn't cut funding for it. In fact, the governor's Office of Emergency Services, which coordinates disaster response across the state, saw a $127 million infusion. Cal Fire, which is the state's firefighting agency, saw an additional $85 million or so to hire 600 people. That was in part to make up for the inmate crews that aren't going to be available because a lot of them were actually let out early. They're also getting more equipment, like 26 Wildland firefighting trucks, these giant metal boxes that go into the worst of it. They're pretty impressive. And they're also getting 12 Black Hawk helicopters, which can fly at night carry more water than the Hueys that they have right now. And they also got some money for wildfire prediction infrastructure. One cut we did see, though, was to a $100 million grant program that was intended to give homeowners money to harden their homes, especially in that wildland urban interface, you know, where people live kind of up in the hills, protect their homes against wildfires so people won't be getting that money.
Now, all that equipment you just mentioned has to be held and run and operated by human beings, firefighters, people.
Yep.
And people are susceptible to coronavirus. So one of the biggest questions is how is our firefighters' ability to fight these wildfires going to be compromised possibly?
Yeah, firefighting agencies are still figuring that out, but they're taking precautions with PPE, quarantining people who get sick. But one of the interesting things is what will happen with evacuations when fires do come through people's communities. And that's this year, people may be asked to leave sooner than in previous years to make things a little bit less hectic. So that's something good to keep in mind if you are deciding to ignore orders, which you shouldn't. Officials are also considering evacuating people to hotel rooms to keep them sequestered instead of gymnasiums. But if they have to use gymnasiums or rec centers, whatever, they'll separate people who are sick from those who aren't. And they've also considered putting up partitions and possibly using air purifiers. But at the end of the day, it's going to be a case-by-case situation.
That's KPCC science reporter Jacob Margolis. Jacob, thanks a lot.
Thanks, A.
All right, now to your stories. KPCC and LAist are documenting life in the new normal with video diaries from everyday Angelenos. Here's a good one if you need some inspiration to get outdoors.
Hi, my name is Maura Hudson. I'm from Long Beach, California. Today is April 29th, Wednesday, and I'm walking in Hartwell Park. I walk 8 miles a day, Monday through Friday, on behalf of the Bixby Knowles Dawn Joggers. I'm also walking and running in preparation for the Boston Marathon, which was supposed to happen a few weeks ago, but due to the coronavirus, was postponed until September. I'm very excited and hopeful that everything works out for September, but in the meantime, I'm walking, I'm running, I'm having a good time with the squirrels, and I encourage everyone to get out there and do their thing. Thank you.
Watch all of Maura Hudson's video and submit your own diary at laist.com. That's LAIST.com. All All right, there's an old saying, you don't know what you got until it's gone. Well, until the coronavirus pandemic shut down all of LA's parks and trails, we probably did take all of them for granted, especially Griffith Park. But now a new book will rekindle your appreciation.
LA has a city park that literally has mountains in it. And I think a lot of people really underestimate that when they think about Griffith Park.
The new book, Discovering Griffith Park, A Local's Guide, is coming up next when Take Two continues. Stay with us.
But you got to go home with me. I forgot some good old loving and I got some in store. When I get through throwing it on you, you got to come back for more. Boys and things will come by the dozen, but that ain't nothing but drugstore loving. Pretty little thing, let me light your count, cause mama, I'm sure hard to hell and I yes around.
Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and the KPCC app. I'm E. Martinez. For me, Griffith Park is one of the most special places in the whole wide world. From running with my uncle up Crystal Springs Drive when I was a kid to playing my high school and college baseball home games there. My first date with my wife was at Travel Town because it was cheap. And then my granddaughter's first hike was with me up to Amir's Garden. I've been exploring every corner of Griffith Park for over 40 years now, and it still feels like there's a lot of stuff I have yet to see. Now, LA's resident hiking expert Casey Schreiner has a new book all about one of the biggest urban parks in North America, offering Griffith Park veterans like myself and the rookies a manual for getting to know it better. It's called Discovering Griffith Park, A Local's Guide. Casey, welcome back.
Thanks so much for having me again.
Now, right off the bat, you acknowledge that this enormous city park is still a mystery to many Angelenos who have lived here a long time. And this is really who your book is for. So we'll dive into a few selected specific things in just a bit. But what's a quick overview of the history of Griffith Park and how it came to be?
The quick history, and this will be very quick, very, very truncated version of the history. It is really the history of L.A. itself. It started out as Tongva land. It became one of the Spanish land grants that was awarded to one of the pobladores, one of the original 44 settlers and soldiers who founded the city of L.A. It was basically taken by Yankee lawyers. It was used for real estate development. And then it eventually came into the hands of Griffith J. Griffith, who donated 3,000 so acres of the land to the city as a city park. So that's how it became a city park, and how LA, which was still, you know, very much a backwater town at that time, instantly overnight, we got a park that was five times the size of New York City's Central Park.
And when it comes to Central Park, I think that becomes most Americans' vision of what an urban park is, but that's a very manicured place. Griffith Park is a whole nother world.
Right. I think when people think of city parks, they think of Central Park. They might think of San Francisco's Golden Gate Park. And those are a little bit more easy to sort of comprehend because they're, you know, they're giant rectangles. They're on a city grid. It's easy to get a sense of how big they are. Griffith Park is five times the size of Central Park. It's four times the size of Golden Gate Park. And it's got that manicured garden aspect. And it's got this sort of like rough, rugged chaparral state. So it's weird. Like, LA has a city park that literally has mountains in it. And I think a lot of people really underestimate that when they think about Griffith Park.
You know, New York Central Park is iconic to the whole nation because of the many movies and TV shows that have been set in Central Park, where it plays a starring role. I mean, you know that you're in Central Park. But even though it's close to Hollywood, Griffith Park has kind of had an uncredited role in a lot of movies and TV shows. Why do you think that is? And does that kind of make it like second fiddle to New York Central Park?
Well, I don't want to say that Griffith is central or second fiddle to Central Park, because
I wouldn't. I'm not saying it. I'm just.
But so the Autry Museum is working on an exhibit on Griffith Park that's really, really great. One of my favorite aspects of that exhibit is they have this running reel of just various movies and TV shows that are shot in Griffith Park. And there's a great quote above it that says, "A tree is a tree, a rock is a rock, shoot it in Griffith Park." It was a really open environment that really could fill in for almost anywhere else in the world. It is in the backdrop of a lot of stuff, but few people, you know, in those movies or TV shows actually say, Let's Go to Griffith Park. I do kind of wonder why that is. I mean, maybe the most starring role was Rebel Without a Cause. You know, we've got the James Dean statue just outside the observatory. And now, of course, people know La La Land. But, you know, even in La La Land, in that famous dance scene, they don't say that they're going to Griffith Park. It just looks like a magical L.A. street. Maybe we should require more people to announce that we're in Griffith Park in the entertainment industry to give it a little bit more love.
Now, the most visible thing in the park, the Hollywood sign, it's on Mount Lee, not on Mount Hollywood.
Yes.
It has many different ways to see it, to access it, and enjoy it. And it helps to know what you want when you want to try and see the Hollywood sign and have a plan. So how did you parse out that part of the book? Because I can imagine that is the number one question, maybe, Casey, that you get asked when you get asked about the Hollywood sign in Griffith Park.
Yeah, and honestly, I think, you know, if you spend more than 2 weeks in L.A., someone will ask you how to get to the Hollywood sign. And unfortunately, what happens is there's like two places that people tend to go to, and then they get there and they see how crowded it is and they get disappointed. There are so many places to see the Hollywood sign from Griffith Park. You do not need to go to the observatory. You do not even need to hike up to Mount Lee to see it. There's about 13 different places that I tell you how to see the Hollywood sign in the book, Discovering Griffith Park, including some of which you don't really even need to hike that much to see him.
We're talking to Casey Schreiner about his new book, Discovering Griffith Park, A Local's Guide. Now, before we get to what I think is the best part of the park, and that's the endless trails and paths, I want to highlight something that people may not be aware of. Tell us about some of Griffith Park's gardens.
Yeah, so Griffith Park has a series of what has been known as volunteer gardens. And they're called volunteer gardens because when they started, people just sort of volunteered, and I'm using air quotes here, their services as gardeners. You know, most of these gardens did not have permission. We're talking about places like Dante's View, the Captain's Roost, which are both on the flanks of Mount Hollywood. Later on, we had Amir's Garden was the first garden that actually had permission from the parks and had help from the city to get it going. And then later on, we've had additional gardens that have sort of come up. The Bird Sanctuary was not a garden initially, but is now getting restored by the Friends of Griffith Park. We've got the De Anza Native Plant Garden on the De Anza National Historic Trail, which is kind of on the east end of the park. And there's a great little butterfly garden that's off the Fern Canyon Trail.
And okay, so you listed 33 hikes in the book, and you rated them as easy, moderate, challenging, and very challenging. So give us an example of each and what goes into their level of difficulty.
For an easy one, again, this is not technically part of Griffith Park, but I included it anyway because people sort of assume that it is part of Griffith Park. But the path around the Hollywood Reservoir is one of my favorite very, very easy paths to send people to. It's pretty flat. It's mostly paved, stroller friendly. It's about 3 miles round trip loop. You get some of what I think are the best Hollywood sign views in the entire park. In terms of moderate stuff, sites like the observatory trails, which are basically from the Trails Cafe up to the observatory and back, those are a little bit steep. You'll definitely huff and puff in a couple sections, but it's not going to knock the wind out of you. For challenging, the Hogback Loop is a pretty famous, well-known trail, especially for trail runners. Again, not too tough, but that Hogback Loop section is very, very steep. And then for like the really, really hard routes, I have two routes that basically traverse the entire park. I really love that west to east route, which basically goes from Cahuenga Peak, which is like the Wonder View trailhead, all the way to the Griffith Park Pony Rise and Train in the far east corner near that Mulholland Fountain. That is a really, really good, mostly full day route with tremendous views. You'll get great solitude in the middle of the park and a tremendous sense of accomplishment when you're done.
And really quick, if heaven forbid something happens, you sprain an ankle or you're injured or something, there are numbers throughout the park, right? And what do those numbers mean?
This actually was a thing that I learned while writing the book. The water tanks all have numbers on them. And basically, if you add a zero to the end of that number on the water tank, that's the elevation of the water tank. But additionally, every route finding trail sign, every trail junction sign, and even some fire hydrants and other infrastructure in the park is spray painted with a number on it. So if you call one of the rangers and you need help, or you're trying to tell them where you are, if you see something with a number on it, tell them that number and they'll know exactly where you are.
All right, now what's the range of living things you might see on a Griffith Park hike?
It's pretty broad. Most visitors to Griffith Park will give you a coyote story. coyotes are pretty much everywhere. Yeah. You will see them throughout the park. You know, they're mostly harmless. They're not going to attack you. They're really smart. Of course, we've got P-22, that charismatic megafauna, celebrity bachelor cat who lives in Griffith Park. There's mule deer that are up there, especially around the Graveyard Memorial Park areas in the north side that are not actually part of the park. And you'll see tons of red-shouldered hawks, red-tailed hawks, peregrine falcons. It's a haven for birders, scrub jays. From bugs, you've got the western fence lizard. Tarantulas are in there. There's a thing called the diabolic armored beetle that lives in Griffith Park. It's just full of wildlife.
You know, Griffith Park, like other outdoor areas, has been off limits because of the pandemic. But now that we're able to go back after losing it for a while, how do you think your book can help add to a renewed appreciation for our urban rural paradise?
You know, I really, really hope that one of the good things that comes out of these stay-at-home orders in this pandemic is a greater appreciation of Griffith Park specifically and LA's parks in general. Looking at the history of LA, we don't have a great track record with parks. If you look at some of these other old parks that LA has, something like MacArthur Park or Elysian Park, you'll see that we basically put freeways through the middle of them and really ruined them as functional parks. Griffith Park, that happened too. You know, we've got the 5 and the 134 running through the park that really cut off the park from the river and are causing some problems now that we're trying to revitalize the river. LA has great, great parks. Griffith Park is a fantastic world-class park. LA needs more parks, and it needs more parks in more places. 40% of Angelenos don't live within a 10-minute walk of a neighborhood park. And that was a big issue. When those parks were closed and we were being told, go walk around your neighborhood, stay local, a lot of people in LA couldn't do that. Yeah. So now that we have our parks open again, I'm hoping that people really appreciate what we couldn't access and appreciate what we now can access. And I'm hoping that they'll fight for more parks in the future and they'll make sure that parks like Griffith stay around for the next 100 years.
Casey Schreiner's beautiful new book is called Discovering Griffith Park, A Local's Guide. Casey, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
All right, I'll admit, I did not think I'd miss sports as much as I have. I've been filling the hole in my sports soul by watching highlights of old games, then forwarding them to Larry Mantle. It's really all the sports we have right now, unless someone maybe makes up a game out of thin air, like tomorrow's Galaxy versus LAFC soccer match. Yeah, that's really going to happen. Find out how when Take 2 continues in 60 seconds. Stay with us.
Listen, oh baby, when the band is playing and that solid beat, I'll make you wanna move and make you wanna groove and make you wanna match your feet. Don't fight it, baby, feel it. Ha. Oh baby, when you're dancing near me with your cheek close to mine and you begin to feel a funny thrill moving up your spine. Don't fight it, baby, feel it. Oh yeah. Baby, when the swinging music make you wanna flip, oh, don't be in pain, try to strain, go on, move your hips. Oh, baby, when you're dancing near me and I feel I wanna tease, and when I do, the feeling get you, you feel you wanna squeeze me. Don't fight it, baby, feel it.
Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC, the KPCC app. I'm E. Martinez. Since the stay-at-home order came down, there's been a whole lot of fun stuff missing in all of our lives. No theme parks, no movie theaters, no sporting events. For example, tomorrow at noon in Bank of California Stadium, it would have been the first meeting of the season between the LA Galaxy and LAFC. The rivalry between LA's two major league soccer clubs even has its own name, El Tráfico, and it's always circled in red ink on calendars of both fans. It's as intense a crosstown rivalry as it gets, and also a whole lot of fun. I mean, it's just a shame it just can't happen, or can it?
From Bank of California Stadium in downtown Los Angeles, it's Faux Tráfico, as LAFC hosts their arch rivals, LA Galaxy. Hello, everyone. I'm Dave Denholm, the voice of LAFC, here at the bank on a beautiful evening in downtown Los Angeles, 72 degrees and a slight breeze as we get ready for kickoff of what should be a perfect night to play football here at the bank.
It is going to happen. Well, in the mind of Dave Denholm, the radio play-by-play voice of LAFC. And since it's technically not real, for tomorrow, El Tráfico will be called Faux Tráfico. Dave, welcome back to Take Two.
Thank you, Harry. Pleasure.
Dave, we've known each other for a long time, over 20 years in sports radio. And a few days ago when you tweeted this, the other day my wife asked me if I thought I could do 90 minutes of soccer play-by-play without an actual game going on, just make it all up. I think I'm getting close to trying it. When I read that tweet, I thought, yeah, whatever, Dave. And then I heard what you put together, and the sports-starved fan in me freaked out. So first off, how did this idea hatch?
Well, it hatched actually as the tweet said. My wife asked me that question one night when we were chatting, and it was kind of just at the start of the lockdown. And so we were just talking about my job. We knew that sports weren't going to be around for a little while, at least. So she asked me, do you think you could do it without a sport going on, any play-by-play or do play-by-play? And I said, no, I don't think I can. And we just kind of forgot about it. And then I just started thinking about it a little bit more and more, and it stuck with me as an idea. So I called my producer, Mario Rees, and talked with him. He usually has good advice for me, and he said, yeah, try it. And that got me more fired up about it, So probably a few weeks later, I took my time to think about how I might be able to do this. And a couple of weeks later, I did give it a shot, and it as it turned out, it worked out.
See, both of our wives have more confidence in our abilities than we do, right? I mean, it just seems like it. Now, you know what this reminds me of? It reminds me of the early days of radio play-by-play sports. That's when a broadcaster in a studio would recreate a game off of wire reports or sometimes by being on the phone with someone who was at the game. How much of that kind of performance theater did you tap into this?
A little bit, yes. As I'm well aware of those situations, too, as we are both big radio fans and we know that history. But what I wanted to do was I decided that I would not have a roadmap for this game. I did not schedule anything out. I did not write anything out. I just was going to let the ball take me where it went in my imagination. And I honestly, the only thing I did think of beforehand, was I did not want it to be 0-0. I didn't want a nil-nil 90-minute game. So I knew there would be a goal or two or maybe even more. I don't want to give away too much. But that was the only thing I planned out in my mind. This will not end a tie at 0-0. So once that happened and the ball kicked off in my head and I heard that first whistle in my mind, I just let it go, and I did not know where it was going to take me. So it's a little different in that sense, but it does draw on those things. I remember a story that I was doing some research. Ronald Reagan at one point had some technical difficulties doing what you were talking about, doing a game off the wire reports. So he had to make up an inning or two, I believe, before it got back to working and he could read the wire reports. Fascinating that those gentlemen did that over the years, nearly, 80, 90 years ago now. And this was something that I did kind of research and draw back on, but I wanted to make sure I did not have any information in front of me that would lead me to where I was going to go. I had no script for this.
Wow. So let's dive into your imagination for a second, Dave, and let's get a taste of some in-game LAFC versus Galaxy action.
12 yards off the sideline, so it's a good angle for the in-swinging left foot of Carlos Vela. 13th minute, no score. LAFC, LA Galaxy here at the bank. As the two teams, you can obviously, it's all about the rivalry, certainly. The two fan bases do not like each other. There's about some 800 who have made the trip wearing the LA Galaxy colors here in the stadium at Bank of California Stadium, but you cannot hear them over the 32-52. Vela is over it with a twist awaiting there. It's going to be Vela's left foot. Here it comes. Sends players in motion with his left hand. Sends it in with the left foot towards the back post. Knocked down there by Kay. Segura tries the shot and just absolutely shanks it. Eddie shaking his head as he's running back there from 17 just inside of the area.
We're talking to Dave Denholm, the radio play-by-play voice of LAFC. I mean, I got goosebumps, Dave. I mean, goosebumps, because it feels like a live sporting event that's happening right now in the moment. That is absolutely amazing. The crowd noise was timed perfectly as well. It's, you know, how long did this all take to put together? Because you mentioned Mario Ruiz, he's the LAFC radio producer. How long did you two have to go to put this together to sound like a real game?
We did a lot of prep work in that I wanted to make sure that I was ready for a regular game, a regular call. So I had all my stats, my sheets all written out.
You treated this
so
like a real prep for a real
yes.
announcement. Wow, my God.
I went through my pregame rituals at home when I was doing it to get ready. I was nervous.
You're a method actor, man. You're a method actor.
I took my 15-minute halftime break the way I normally would and then went right back to it. But Mario, I'm glad you brought this up. Mario had such difficult work to do on this, and he did a great job, but he had hours and hours and hours of matching up my call with what he thought the audio would be within Banc of California Stadium. And he's been there since day one as well with this new team at the bank. So he had all the audio. He had the 32-52 chanting and screaming. He had all the goal calls and what the fans and how they react. And he did a great job. There's, I guess the kids call them Easter eggs. There's some special little surprises for people in there audibly throughout the match that Mario made sure was as accurate as he possibly could. So it took me hours before the game in terms of prep and really getting wrapping my mind around how I might be able to do this and making sure all my notes were correct. And then, of course, the 90 minutes plus halftime, basically two-hour broadcast. And then it took Mario several days to really put the finishing touches on it that just take it to a new level.
Now, this is going to be technically an LAFC broadcast, so I can't imagine, Dave Denholm, that LAFC will lose this game.
I do not want to give any spoilers away. I will tell you this, there are plenty of surprises for everybody. I think and I hope Galaxy fans might even be able to enjoy this.
Oh, all right, we'll see. That's Dave Denholm, radio play-by-play voice of LAFC, and you can listen to Fo Tráfico tomorrow at noon on LAFC.com. And we're going to go out on another call from the game. Dave, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Katai manages to hold it up, stolen away there by Palacios. Good job by Diego Palacios to dig in with that left foot. Palacios down the line to Rodriguez. Rodriguez now, he has a chance to settle in front of Felcher. Rodriguez cutting it back towards the middle with a right foot. Rodriguez around Felcher, edge of the area. Rodriguez, shot, save! Bingham on the far side, and he tips it wide. Oh, what an effort there. The first shot on goal, that one by Brian Rodriguez in the 17th minute. And it nearly made it 1-0. It'll be a corner kick.
Wow, so cool. LAFC. All right, finally, we have plans for your weekend if you need to let loose or even get out.
I'm KPCC's Leo Duran and A. Martinez. With some relaxation on what can stay closed and what can open, there are a few things to do in Southern California that can get you outside while still practicing physical distancing.
All right, and the first one involves never leaving the comfort of your car.
Yeah, a drive-through. Now, not just any drive-through. This one is in the Grove, like literally in the Grove streets.
Ooh.
The roads will open for the first time in its history tomorrow to host a special drive-through restaurant. It's by the Miramar To-Go food truck, and all the meals sold will help out the nonprofit Para Los Niños. And it's going to be a really unique experience since, of course, the Grove is only for pedestrians. That starts tomorrow at noon, and prices vary depending on what you order.
I've always wanted to cruise through the Grove. I've driven past it. Now I'm going to get to go through it. Now,
yeah.
For people craving nature, there's a chance to get outside.
Yeah, because starting tomorrow in La Cañada Flint Ridge, Descanso Gardens will be reopening. Now, there are new rules here. Everyone must wear a face covering. Non-members can only buy tickets online in advance, and those tickets are limited to maintain physical distancing. If you miss going this weekend, the Gardens will release new blocks of tickets on Tuesdays at 10 in the morning. And when you go, those admission fees start at $5.
Finally, this last event is online and not outdoors, but it does help support our wild animals who are...
Yeah, tonight at the LA Zoo, it's hosting a big fundraiser for Endangered Species Day. It's called the Virtual Beastly Ball, hosted by Joel McHale, star of Community, by the way, I have been rewatching, and it mostly holds up. This live event will have an auction, conservation stories, plus extra special guests like Lance Bass and Lisa Ling. However you take part, the funds will go to helping the zoo with its animal care and conservation efforts. But it is free to stream into your own home via Facebook and YouTube. Now, there are still a bunch of events to go to, whether online or driving around. To find out more, head to our site, laist.com. That's laist.com. Plus, you can follow me on Twitter, at Leo Has a Cat.
All right, that's KPCC's Leo Duran. Leo, thanks a lot.
Thanks, A.
All right, finally today, the global pandemic has forced universities across the country to either cancel or postpone their in-person graduation ceremonies. But that's not stopping them from celebrating the class of 2020 online. And today, it's graduation day for USC. University of Southern California held a virtual ceremony today to celebrate its more than 19,000 students receiving degrees. USC President Carol Folt started things off with some words of encouragement for the grads.
You're probably asking, even with this superb education from USC, will I make it? You will. And you won't just survive, you'll thrive. Your ability to collaborate, connect, and get things done even during a pandemic is truly extraordinary.
The celebration featured appearances from past commencement speakers, including journalist Lisa Ling, author Deepak Chopra, and actor Rainn Wilson. Comedian Will Ferrell even dropped in and did his best Oprah impression.
Every graduate is getting a new car. Every graduate is getting round trip tickets for him and her and their family to the Bahamas or Tahiti. Whenever it's okay to travel again.
He doesn't even sound anywhere near her. All right, and they actually got a hold of that. Now, to mark the occasion, we asked USC graduates to their feelings of graduating during a global crisis.
Even though, like, I'm not there with my classmates or my professors and everyone who's helped me out in my career, I feel like I was able to celebrate it with my family and in the comfort of my own home.
Melody Weintal is a first-generation transfer student. Today, she graduated with a BA in journalism from the Annenberg School. And for now, she plans to continue her journalism pursuits as a freelancer. Roy Pineda earned his Bachelor of Architecture degree today.
You know, not many people can claim that they graduated during a global pandemic. And looking at the positive side of this, you know, this is a really historical moment to sort of be living through and graduating during this time. So this is definitely one for the books. And I just feel happy and super grateful that, you know, I accomplished this milestone and I'm here in the presence of my family.
Pineda said he's looking forward to entering the job market and seeing how the architecture world will respond to this moment in time. Now, to all the young Trojans who digitally walked today, fight on. And just to share the spotlight a little, in just a few minutes, UCLA law students will attend their graduation online as well. So a healthy congratulations to all. All right, that's it for Take Two this week. Our show was directed by Lori Skywalker Galaretta. Our producers, Austin Cross, Leo Duran, and Jonathan Shiflett. Darby Maloney helped edit this week. Marina Pena is our news apprentice. Hazmik Bogosian and Eduardo Perez are our engineers. And our senior producer is Megan Larson. You can always find us on Twitter. We're at Take Two. That's at Take Two. I'm there as well, at A Martinez LA. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take Two is back Monday at 2. Talk to you then.